different standard of satisfaction. It would be very difficult, therefore, to assume that this world can be rapidly transformed in its totality, picked up as a globe, so to say, and carried from one level of integrity to another. Western mysticism meets this possible conflict of concepts with the other situation then, that man's own life becomes to a measure a psychosomatic symbol of the whole world. The world as we know it here is made up of an infinite number of beings capable of the statement of I. These beings exist as individuals, but each of these individuals is in a world and is the victim of a world arising within himself and flowing outward into his environment, or moving from his environment in upon himself. Thus, each person becomes symbolical of the transference of heaven to earth, the bringing of a spiritual state into objectivity within the consciousness of man, the possibility of creating within man the utopian, the individual who possesses the virtues which he desires to have the community virtues of his world. That it is conceivable that the individual can attain this has not been denied. And the resulting thought, of course, that brings some optimism, but restrained, is that enough persons gradually coming to this individual discovery could go a long way towards ultimately moving the collective in that direction. Because by degrees, individuals becoming, as they are, the units of masses. If enough individuals move in a direction, the mass moves in that direction. So mysticism for Western man has to be solutional of something. It is not his departure from life into some mysterious nirvana. It is rather the departure of his ailments, the departure of his difficulties, and the final integration and organization of himself as a directive leader of his own fate, with both the wisdom and the strength to be a good leader, to be capable of preserving the peace in his own nature and living according to it. Mysticism for this man cannot be totally disassociated from his immediate needs. And I think it will come into our Western world through the recognition of a process of therapy in which the individual, by the cultivation of certain laws, principles, and practices of mystical procedure, will discover that these put his personal life in order, and that by putting his personal life in order, they accomplish most of the byproducts which he desires. His confusion in all its manifestation represents byproduct. The fact that he is in his present sorry state results from this lack of organization. It is itself a byproduct. So if we wish to say that man's sickness, physical sickness, is to a measure psychosomatic, that many of the ailments which are increasing at the present time are directly traceable to tension, or to one or other of the excesses by which the individual hazards his life. If we also want to assume that domestic problems, juvenile problems, vocational maladjustments, all these things to a measure result in man energizing the wrong values, then it means that by the re-education of his basic value sense, much can be accomplished. To re-educate the value sense in man, we may need and will probably ultimately develop a series of disciplines based upon Eastern techniques, but probably a little like some of the adaptations of Eastern art and architecture to our Western way of life, coming upon us almost unawares. Perhaps the architectural situation will be of some use to us at the moment in trying to make a point here. We have several great systems of foreign architecture, particularly Oriental, that have been neglected for a long time because for years, for centuries, our public buildings were Greco-Roman, our cathedrals were mostly Gothic, our monuments largely Gothic or Baroque, or if we were extremely luxurious and wanted to finally indicate beyond all doubt that we had wealth and culture, we ran into that glorious, spindly, gold leaf situation that dignified the Louis of France from the 16th to the 18th, and immediately following the 18th, the deluge. This situation caused us a lot of discontent. Now, we have many schools of Eastern architecture. And it is interesting that in selecting by our own subconscious or by the subconscious of our art directors or interior decorators, however, they don't get very far unless the client pays them, so it all goes back again to what is acceptable or what the individual is willing to live with. Out of all the systems that could have been drawn upon, the simplest was selected, and that was the Japanese. And it is distinguished by under-furnishing, under-ornamentation, and such problems as bringing outdoors indoors, some magnificent garden composed of nothing but five rocks and combed sand, a delightful and glorious house in which, theoretically, if not actually, and ultimately, perhaps actually, you do not even have to continue to live in rooms of the same sizes and shapes. You get tired of your living room, you pull three or four silk partitions one way or the other, and your living room becomes anything you want it to be. You can take all the partitions of the house down if you want to, and change a nine-room house into one room. Or you can, if you're a little tired of that, you can put up so many partitions that it will make a house that resembles a cell block at Sing Sing. You can have what you want. You live in walls that are only where you want them to be. And that's Zen. The ability to change the shape of your room to meet the shape of your life. You can also realize that your consciousness following into all of these shapes can be any and all of them. Your consciousness can be a one-room house consciousness or a nine-room house consciousness. You can have a consciousness that wishes to be alive with the sky or the air and wants no walls. And you have complete control over whether you want walls or not. It is not necessary for you to blast through 16 feet of solid concrete, as in the time of Richard the Lionhearted, in order to get into a house. In those days, they built walls to keep people out. And what did they do? They kept the people on the inside in. And every barrier we build to protect ourselves imprisons ourselves. So suddenly, we like to see rivers flowing into our living room. We like to see doors and windows where walls used to be. And we like walls that we can argue with a little bit, pushing them this way, getting rid of them that way if we don't like them. We are tired of the bric-a-bracs and of the oddments and all this type of thing. And our taste today moves toward this openness, this broad sweep, this lack of boundaries. It tells us something. It is all part of a kind of an astute full of formula, a Zen formula. And when we are thinking of art today, we go into the Zen type of Jinri art. We go into an art that goes back to the basic value of simple line and the tremendous importance of the full consciousness of line and color. These things point out psychological changes, and they also point out the desire of the person not to be cluttered. This against clutteredness is showing up all through our culture. It is showing up everywhere where man has been for ages cluttered. His house is nothing more or less than his escape from himself. He is doing with his house what he wants to do with himself. And his relation to his house to himself is the relation of his psyche to his being. And today he is very anxious to get rid of a cluttered up psyche. And he has learned that one way that he can get rid of it is simply to make his walls of paper and silk instead of iron and steel. That he also can get rid of it by getting rid of debris, of clutterage. And psychology may slowly realize, as it has, that a badly demoralized psyche is very much like a room over-furnished. Back in the old days when nothing was ever thrown away, in the days when the portieres were threaded eucalyptus buds alternating with leaves, when small window curtains were beautifully festooned out of father's cigar bands, in those days, nothing was ever lost. The drapes were hung with little pinned reproductions of children's drawings that had been there. The wedding wreaths were underneath glass bells. Everything was velour and velvet and felt. Every tabletop resembled a present piece of kitchenware. It was heavily loaded with marble and mosaic, or something that was the 19th century equivalent of linoleum. Linoleum was liable to appear in the living room just as well as anywhere else. For portraits of those long dead, most of them apparently having died of various types of grievances from the expressions, were everywhere. This was the stuffy old psyche. This was the individual living in an atmosphere in which there was no freedom for his own soul. He lived overshadowed by the grimness of hereditary bestowals. And the psychologist today, trying to explain to the individual that he is suffering from a broken home, and the individual going back and visualizing that early childhood difficulty, is in very similar condition to the same man going to the family homestead, going into this room and seeing these grim-faced relatives glowering down upon him from across the years. Relatives that still live in him as part of his psychic content. Situations that mean that he has inherited this whole stuffy mess and that he has carried it on through the years. Now, it's wonderful for someone to try to put these things in order, but you cannot put a good many of them in order. There's only one thing to do with them: throw them away. They are of no importance to anyone. These cherished things that 50 years ago would have been lovingly preserved at the cost of life. If the house was on fire, the individual would gladly have been burned to death rescuing them. These things are now worthless. We cannot say in psychoanalysis, learn to get used to them. What's the use? We cannot say, well, don't forget that this hatchet-faced ant up on the wall was really the victim of a bad psychotic time herself. Look how her parents treated her and how their parents treated them. So gradually learn to see the good in your miserable old man. Learn to see that underneath she is only the symbol of your own frustration. What's the use? Just take the picture and turn it to the wall. Or better still, throw it away. Now you can go through this same room and you can try to reconcile yourself. You can say, yes, these gorgeous portieres of eucalyptus buds were wonderful at the time they were made. They were the production of loving spinster sisters who had nothing much more important to do because they couldn't play the piano all the time. These things have sentiment to them. They are nostalgic. They have a sacredness about them. They made somebody very happy, or at least help somebody to be unhappy in a pleasant manner. This situation causes them to be part of us, to be part of our background. Well, we can do that. We can take them down and we can carefully roll them up and say sometimes somebody may want them, although we know they never will. Or we may try to live with them. We may try to clear our dream life so that we can wander through this house and this room whistling with sheer joy because we understand everything in it so well. It's all reconciled now. But what have we done? We've reconciled ourselves with something that wasn't anything in the first place, that had certain, perhaps, excuses for existence, but never any reasons. It belonged to a way of life that was dated like a geological strata. Once it's gone, with it went the dinosaur and the megatherium. There's no further relationship in these things. Now, if our own haunted house, our own psychic nature, carries this tremendous burden, there's no real gain from trying to rationalize it, from trying to accept it, from trying to say, I'll live with it, regardless. Well, maybe we could live with it, but it means nothing. It is only punishing ourselves for no purpose. It would be very much better to take a perfectly simple Zen attitude in this, because a Zen monk coming in, looking around very carefully, would probably burn the place. In other words, it would be the simplest answer. There's no need, there's nothing to be gained from it. It has no answers for questions or problems that we mean or that we need. Consequently, if the whole situation dies out in us completely and totally, it is far better. There is also no reason why we should go around in the presence of this saying, I don't like it. But because I don't like it, I must now accuse myself of being disloyal to it. It's not any good. I know it isn't any good. But I have loyalties. I am in some way required by a code to protect this thing and, if possible, transform it into a national monument. It must go on. Now, many people kill themselves with that type of loyalty. And nothing gained again. So mysticism, cutting through all of this, gives us the concept of the simple house. The house in which the walls are very simple, in which things that are no longer valuable are buried honorably, where their ghosts will no longer walk, where these situations can no longer arise, and the individual lives in the free air. Looking out through these cloistered and sorry walls, back to the sky and the earth, which were his common parents. Here lies man's return to value and escaping the stumbling block of trying to get there by passing through a mystic maze of everybody else's values, which he can never do anything about anyway. He does not need to say his ancestors were wrong any more than he hopes his descendants will say that he is wrong. But these things do not add anything. And while we are fighting with these, struggling with them, trying to root them out one by one. The years go by, the sickness goes on, and the person who's cured of one ailment simply turns his face to another corner of the same room and is just as sick again. It is the same problem, infinitely repeating itself. Today, physically, we would scarcely do this anymore. It's on rare occasions now that persons literally hold on to things this way. The outer symbolism is broken by the five senses that can't tolerate it. But the interior symbolism is held together by subjective pressures and by a certain psychic loyalty. And perhaps this peculiar tie back to the past, which is part of the psychological entity of all of us, and which unfortunately is not always tied to the right part of the past. There is a value in that tie, but only when it is properly and adequately used. The psychic mystic problem goes into this gradual fading away of false value, the getting away from this miserable conglomerate into simplicity again. And the house of today is a little bit symbolic of that. Some of these modern houses are pretty bad. But the principle of getting away seems to be driving the individual, driving him to more or less stylized expressions of living, in which he is less and less a slave to literal particulars, but prefers rather to live in an atmosphere of broad, almost metaphysical implications. He is depending less and less upon the completeness of design. He is expecting that completeness to be supplied rather than provided. He expects the individual who beholds it to sense something more than he sees. And he leaves the situation in this way, rather open and fluid, which is much better for his psyche. If we would take this architectural release that he has gained and try to apply it to his interior psychic life, we would begin to understand perhaps something of mystical content. The rebellion on the outside is almost a mandala. The rebellion on the outside gives him a tremendous symbolic instrument to work with. And here we come to, I think, a very powerful factor in this entire situation. Man finds it comparatively easy to follow lines that are familiar to him. As he becomes adjusted to one level of a value, he becomes adapted to other less obvious value levels that are similar. Thus the person living in the open house with its very simple, austere human factors, depending more and more upon nature moving in upon it. This individual is constantly contemplating a value. Perhaps he didn't originally build a house that way. Perhaps an architect built it, or a decorator provided the furnishings. Perhaps it was only a stylization when he moved in. But if it was well done, this stylization begins to move in him. And the mandala is always the thing on the outside that starts something working on the inside. It is something that by looking at, or by studying, or by contemplating, we create a series of reminiscent revelations. Something moves in upon us, something moves out to meet it. And the thing that moves out to meet it is usually our need, moving out to meet a supply of some kind. Or it is a quality within ourselves, moving out to a different quantity of that quality in the thing outside of us. The mandala in Oriental art is consequently usually a highly symmetrical and highly symbolical structure. It is a design that is lawful in its formation and is peculiarly and specially intended to portray a principle, and to portray it in a way that is acceptable to us, inasmuch as the portrayal is accomplished by archetypal symbols. By archetypal symbols, we mean symbols which in the subconscious of all persons must be essentially interpreted in the same way as against the common symbol, which is capable of any kind of interpretation. Archetypal symbols usually, therefore, go back to the great motions of humanity, to the great religions, the great structures, by means of which a certain device or figure brings to the conscious attention of the individual certain factors, certain thoughts, certain restorations of memory, which he will share with millions of others who look upon the same device, because the symbols themselves are archetypal and are so intended to be. If, therefore, the individual creates an archetypal order in his life, he is constantly releasing this archetype. And in the releasing of it, he finds positive experience as against negative experience. Now, it probably is too soon to say that the American house builder is actually fulfilling or obeying the essential principles of all these archetypes. He is not. The Eastern master would not permit one column, window, or door in that building to be placed without absolute consideration for law. The Western master will not do that. He is merely concerned with the general effect. But the general effect is improving to a degree. Therefore, it is telling us something of man's recognition of archetypal symbol factors in his own life. It is telling us, for example, that man wants to allow nature to move in upon him more. He wants to live in a larger world. He wants to also live in a world in which he draws from basic resources. He wants to live in an uncluttered world. And he wants to live in a world that reminds him of universals rather than particulars. He wants to reduce, therefore, the furnishing of this house to its utilities and to such elements of essential decoration as have the greatest basic significance for him. Thus he appoints into his house no longer a mass of confused things, but a reduction in which his emphasis is upon luxury as the right of beauty rather than the right of clutteredness. It used to be that if you were very, very luxurious, you loaded everything. A luxurious individual had 9 times as many chairs as he needed. The luxurious individual had much larger pompons on the end of his curtain cords. He also had magnificent diapered plush edging on the curtains, so that every time you moved the curtain, it was as though you were moving the entire structure of history. And of course, it was just as dusty usually. But there was mass that counted. Tremendous evidence of this. Today, we find one good painting, one fine piece of sculpturing. Perhaps neither the painting or the sculpturing too good in substance, but simplification, definite reduction. It may be the selection of the art is not real, does not represent personal taste, maybe only general convention, but it is reduced to a recognition that a few things become important in themselves. Many things lose all importance. We go into the life of the person with the same thing. Our great psychological problem today is this clutteredness, which is resulting in desperation, emergency feeling within ourselves. We feel like the young wife coming into one of these ancestral manses and feeling the almost irresistible desire to throw it all out. She is overwhelmed by factors that were never her own, that meant nothing to her, and close in upon her like ancient relatives. She wants to rebel against them. She wants to furnish the place over again, to furnish it according to the living desires of her own nature. The same thing has to happen in the person. Coming into our own subconscious, which is a conglomerate of many things, including pressures, traditions, our own bad habits, and everything you can think of. The individual either has to put this thing in order, or else he has to live in a continual state of internal irritation. Now, perhaps the psychologist in this place becomes the interior decorator. He has to try to rearrange these elements of design. But he assumes that they all have to stay there. He assumes also that if he rearranges these things, that he can arrange them until they are better for the patient because of formulas that he possesses, and that he is the one who must decide what is normal and what is abnormal, that it is necessary for the patient to fulfill a series of rules to achieve certain particular victories over certain things, and that the final victory to be attained is the ability to live with the ravage. That the individual must be able to live in the haunted house and laugh at the ghost. That seems to be the real end that we're working for. That he must be able to get along with the inconsistencies in himself. That he must live in this house unfurnished by taste, but filled with accumulated furniture and fixtures. The East will not permit this attitude in its basic thinking. It is not that the psychological adjustment is so that the person can live with himself. This is only an excuse. And actually doesn't work. The individual who has reached the point where he can live with himself doesn't want him. He still finds himself totally boring, uninteresting, and unpredictable and inexplicable as far as its own nature is concerned. When you learn to live with the psyche, you are only learning to live with a mystery because of the fact that even psychology cannot tell you what it is. This is not the end that is sought. Rather, the end is to clear away the entire structure through, we'll say, the development of a recognition of universal taste. When the person has good taste, he is capable of cleaning his own house. As long as a decorator does the job, we are never sure that the person himself is going to be happy. After the decorator has finished the house, the decorator has to a measure pleased himself, but he is not going to live in the house. Perhaps the person for whom he has decorated the house has given him, as far as possible, the ideas. But you'd be surprised how many people get an expensive decorating firm and then have no ideas of their own at all. They just move in into the grandeur that the decorator has conceived. And as one individual told me after living in it for 6 months, he put his desk and card table out in the garage because he couldn't live in the grandeur. He had a decorated home that cost him $250,000. He couldn't live in it. It wasn't his home. He had been raised in a farmhouse. He had happened to get rich. But still, this glory of it all simply pressed in upon him, giving him the most terrible mental inferiority complex. He felt himself incapable of living on so high a standard of elegance and opulence. So the attempt to reorganize these interiors according to a formula, the attempt to take the individual's life and straighten it out in terms of Freud or in terms of Adler, or in terms of any of these psychologists, assumes that they have to be right, and also that a broad formula, not too broad actually, is applicable to most people. These facts have never been demonstrated in psychoanalysis. That certain pressures can be reduced, the individual can be counseled into a better state of living, is undeniably true. But this same individual may go back for counseling 6 months later with a new problem and the whole thing start over again. The actual achievement of a proven norm has not taken place. And of course the counselor is in trouble on this also, because as soon as the patient feels well enough to get along without him, he doesn't come back. And most of the time, even the treatment that is available is never completed. So you don't get too far with it. Mysticism, by getting behind the whole situation, helps the individual to recognize cluttedness and order. It helps him to recognize simplicity and confusion. And if he can recognize those two groups of couplets, he is pretty well out of his troubles on almost everything. If he will cling to order and cling to simplicity, he will never be very far from integration and improvement of health and attitude. It is when he departs from these basic things that he then requires every type of psychological help that he can possibly receive. So in the West, I believe that we are going to begin not to probe the individual continuously to find out what is lurking in the subconscious. We are rather going to realize that if man has been conditioned by environment, and this conditioning moving in upon him has caused the situation that we generally recognize as psychotic, that we have learned a tremendous fact about man. We have learned that something from the outside can move in upon the inside and make a profound effect upon the inside of life. Now, we have allowed this to always be a more or less detrimental thing. Although nature is constantly reminding us that through this experience pattern from the outside, nature itself is perfecting her own accomplishment. But what comes in through these sensory perceptions and goes into the inner life of man as a modifying force can be either orderly or disorderly. We get back to the simple problem of Pythagorean philosophy. Namely, that Pythagoras believed that medicine could be taken into the body through the eyes and the ears. That part which is taken in at the mouth has the greatest effect upon the body. That which is taken in upon with the eyes has the greatest amount of effect upon the psyche. And that which is taken in through the ears has the greatest effect upon the mind. That these represent, therefore, senses, the eyes, instruction, the ears, nutrition, the mouth. The medicines can come through all three of these avenues. And in your mystical lore, the eyes have become tremendously important on the psychic or soul level. The ears play a subordinate but also often important role. But the eyes particularly give man the experience of beauty. They give man the power to contemplate the orderliness of life, and they can be focused upon the meditation forms, medicine through the geometric arrangements of devices, the mandala, the flower arrangement, the tea ceremony, everything by means of which the individual becomes capable of receiving into his nature the archetypal symbols of contentment, order, relaxation, peace, integration. These things can move in upon him just as surely as chaos can move in upon him. And through meditation, the individual, through increasing discrimination, makes more and more use of these available faculties and powers. Always with the purpose of receiving into himself certain impressions, and then moving these impressions by his own interior energies. In this respect, supposing the individual seated quietly in some convenient area in the process of his mystical thinking, looks out across the landscape, sees hills and valleys and the little town, and becomes very much aware of the type of scene that we have with the story of Gray's Elegy. A very pastoral scene. A scene in which the human interference to nature is very slight, and a wonderful soft glow hangs over life. The simple glow of nature itself. Now this contemplating person, being, we'll say for this moment, a mystic, now returns to the common concerns of the day, or perhaps to the concerns of rest. And in his inner life, he restores this pattern. He begins to build his concept of interiors upon the placidity of nature which he has seen around him. Thus the pastoral scene moving in upon himself with its attendant emotional tranquillities give him a kind of experience which he can internally estimate. As he therefore becomes more adroit at these things, more advanced in the usages of them, he finds the very definite possibility of reorienting his attitudes toward life. He finds that as he sits quietly, looking out upon the thing as it is, that he realizes the life apart from the desperate desire to change that thing. He knows perfectly well that if a real estate agent was sitting there, the place would be mentally subdivided within 5 minutes. Man would move in upon it. That 100 different motives of profit or gain could be contemplated by looking out over that landscape. But if you do not have those motives within your own consciousness, if rather you are accepting this scene as therapy, as a kind of medicine arising from restoring strong, real relationships between yourself and life, you will have a different type of experience, and a rich one, and an enriching one. Gradually, you will also gain a skill in this. You will gain the possibility to achieve this orientation in ever more confused situations. You will find that someday you can look out of an office window upon a busy street with all its traffic and its noises and its confusion, and still with this interior apperception you will be able to put this thing in order. You will be able to completely transcend its ability to confuse you, yet you will not deny its existence, deny its effects, or minimize it, or ignore it, but it simply will not have the power to disorganize you or cause you to be lost in that confusion. Mysticism can make you a kind of in the world, but not totally of the world. It permits you to do everything that you normally would do or that others would find it proper for you to do, and yet do it in an unworldly way. You can do these things without ever becoming so involved in them that you bestow upon them the right to hurt you. The moment you do something and become involved in it, you are going to be hurt by the one who doesn't appreciate it. Zen would strike at this thing with everything that it has, with a sharp knife, because as long as the other person can hurt us, we will be in pain, even to the end of time. We will blame the other person, and to the end of time, it will be ourselves at fault. It is this case of the wrong placing of the blame will lead to modern Western psychotic situation. It is only mysticism that can prevent the wrong placing of the blame. It is only a degree of consciousness that is strong enough not to place blame. That is the only absolute remedy for the situation. The consciousness to whom blame or not blame becomes equally unimportant, inasmuch as all things are done for the sake of themselves. All good is for the sake of good. All truth is spoken for the sake of truth. It is not to please nor to displease, to gain nor to cost. It is not to add or to diminish. It is not to satisfy or dissatisfy. As the Oriental mystic points out, the thing is done because of the necessity within the thing itself to be done. It must be fulfilled. And being fulfilled in this way, nothing is neglected and no one is hurt. It is not a case of the individual doing certain things regretfully or other things with great gusto and glee. It is that the simple problem of the doing of the thing because the doing of that thing is next. In mysticism, there is this complete detachment from the consequences in terms of other people's reactions. The great problem is that the mystic must be moved by a standard of value in which he is constantly mindful of his responsibility to truth for the use of truth. He is not censored by others, he is censored by the deed he performs. He is censored by the word he speaks. He is censored by the thought he thinks, and not by the judgment of other persons. If he can understand this, gradually these psychic pressures will diminish in his own nature. He will find that the desire to push by exercise of will against inevitable ceases. When a thing has to be pushed, it is not timely. Now you will say, but many things would never get done if we didn't push them. That isn't true. If we understand what is meant by mysticism. Mysticism is not achieved by the weight of the push. Mysticism is achieved by the inevitable integrity of the purpose. It can and must be preserved with a certain simple dignity. And experience has shown that the absolute integrity of the purpose is stronger than a push. Yet there must be one or the other, where we're not too easily able to prove our point, we push. Where the value is itself moving the situation, it moves itself if we become its servant. Therefore, the mystic clearly, interiorly visualizes and states. And if his integrity and his visualization is true, the thing is pushed, but not by effort. It is moved by its own inevitable need. It is moved by the fact that it is trusted to a law, and because it is lawful, it must win. It is where we have to defend that which is not lawful that we have to push so hard. With all this pushing comes exhaustion. With exhaustion, irritation. With irritation, more pushing. And finally, we tie ourselves into a hopeless complex. So psychology today is beginning to seriously investigate this Zen concept of effortless effort. This process by means of which we simply do not fight all of these complexes that we have, but substitute for this battle that we have previously fought a very simple and direct positive search for value. So search for the thing we have not had, the reason for being different from what we are. Value, if recognized, becomes worthy of service. The individual will remain as he is until value teaches him or informs him or reveals to him that he is not in harmony with that which is valuable. So in psychology, we are developing this value penetration in which we believe firmly that if the person has a greater appreciation for beauty and understands it better, a greater recognition of nature and a simple acceptance of nature, a greater variety of natural, simple, constructive interests, and a stronger internal meditative life, not meditating for what he wants, but meditating to experience the state he needs, achieving through experience and meditation and diversification the personal awareness of a state of existence better than he is. In other words, that in moments like Plotinus, in these moments he will suddenly experience himself as being better than he is, or better than he knows that he is. There will be moments in which he will be picked up into peace. There will be seconds occur to him in which the confusion will open and he will see the bright light of sky beyond. There will be moments in which he will experience a greater peace than he has ever known. Then the currents will close again and he will be swirled along into another uncertainty. But as he cultivates interiors, he will have these moments. You'll have these moments in meditation or in the very simple association with the necessary. And out of these moments, he gradually will integrate his positive philosophy. He will say to himself, whatever that mood is that I had, I don't know what it is, but that mood is value. That mood is the thing which, if I could possess it, I would need nothing else. That mood would end all interval of misunderstanding between myself, and also between myself and every other living creature. Therefore, this mood of value must be cultivated. It is not a matter of education. It is not a matter of the overcoming of every other fault that I possess. It is simply the effort to cultivate a few positive values, a positive realization of something. And even the troubled person can search for some value. Value in religion, value in a good book, value in a work of art, value in a pleasant walk in the garden, value in the kindly office of a friend, value in one of a thousand different things. The experience of value is the first and simplest form of illumination. And it is also the thing that becomes the guide of our lives. Because the moment we experience a superior state, we are moved to make that state real, to build it into ourselves as a permanent part of our own natures. As time goes on, I hope that we shall be able to do more with this subject, because it opens a new concept of many things. But tonight we are past our time, so I guess we have done all that we can for this evening. And remember that next week we begin...